the sixth class in this ancient wisdom for modern life. So last week I said what we look at today is what the Buddha didn't get to deal with, because what we have with social media is like the sum is greater than the parts, and when you mix social and media together, they become much stronger than just one or the other. So it does go along on this same theme. We've been looking at the six factors that cause disturbing emotions, and so all six of them together create the perfect storm. But even just a couple of them together, as we've seen, create the perfect storm or create enough difficulties. So in particular with social media, the best that we can hope to do is to figure out how to guard ourselves and how come we're so vulnerable to it, because that's really where the Buddha's wisdom comes into it, why it's run away with us so quickly, how we can safeguard ourselves to protect our own mind and our own peace of mind, guard, take control of our own mind, and how we can safeguard society so that we don't ruin our society and we don't harm others, and that we can keep whatever type of democracy that we have and so that we don't succumb to all the disturbing emotions which can arise from all of that. So weapons of mass distraction is what we're looking at today. So we'll have a look at how social media has changed our society, the external, and how it's rewired our brain. So there's more and more stuff neurologically about how it's affected us. Then how we can harness this power for good, because we can. We're doing it right now, being online. And then how we can develop what's called the ease of equanimity. So having a mind that has a sense of equanimity, so we don't go up and down in response to what the barrage is of social media and the ups and downs that we emotionally can go through when there's that kind of online pile-on, everybody having their say very fast without paying any attention to what they're saying. And if we get time, there is a reflection called World of Support. So I think that's in your notes, but it's a really nice one to do. So even if we just do a short kind of cut down one of that. So, yes, the weapons of mass distraction are, because they're together, what happens is that they amplify each other and they're incredibly fast. So back in the day when we just had a village or just had a suburb, you know, when football teams were just in their actual suburb and things like that, even if there was a whole lot of miscommunication happening or a lot of hatred, it was kept in quite a small group. But now, of course, globalization, it's just instantaneously all around the world, even if it's just for a moment or two. So the effect is enormous. So let's take a moment to set our motivation and welcome Jinx online. Very nice that you're here, and I'm hoping there's another lady that's coming tonight as well. So let's just adjust our posture first. Striking a nice balance between keeping your spine relatively straight and then having your body relaxed and comfortable. So imagine a thread of light running from the base of your spine up through your body, coming out the crown of your head. And you are suspended by this thread of light, just like a Christmas bauble. All the weight of your body supported from your crown. Feel how your spine will naturally adjust. So it's still keeping the natural curvature, but becoming a little bit more alert or straight. And then let your shoulders drop. Release the tension from the neck and the shoulders. Also relax the jaw. Put a slight smile on your lips and the tongue on the top teeth behind the upper palate. Let your eyes be just slightly open so some light comes in, and release any tension held around the eyes. And become present where you're sitting. Feel the support of the chair or your seat. And we can reflect that even though our mind is timeless, it's ageless, at this moment we do find ourselves in the modern world, and there are some characteristics of the modern world that can harm us. They have the potential to help, but they also have the potential to harm. What we say and what we say online can have an enormous effect. The power of our speech, our written word, so we find ourselves in this unique position. So we can set our motivation that with these incredibly powerful tools at our disposal, may we always be able to use them only to benefit ourselves and to benefit others, and to never harm. And given that we have very little control over our external circumstances and conditions, but we can gain control over our internal environment, our mind and our emotions, our attitudes. We can think that by guarding our mind, we ourselves can become peaceful and we can become safe human beings to be with. And if we do this, then we can also be a positive force in the world, a positive influence. We could even set our motivation to become the ultimate influencer, a fully enlightened Buddha who can help everybody in whatever way that they need. So with this motivation, then take a nice deep breath in through the nose. Gently release the breath and bring your focus back to the room. Okay, so let's start with the most tricky part, which is how come social media has such a huge hold on us? Why does it have such a massive effect? And how come it's kind of run away with us? And it comes back to something that we've mentioned a couple of times in this course already, called the reifying view. You remember the tyranny of the reifying view? Do you remember anything about what the reifying view is? Just roughly, randomly off the top of your head? Something or other to do with... So reifying means that we think that it exists how it appears, that we believe the appearances. And usually how something first appears to us, we think that that is the thing, that's exactly how it is. So from their side. And so the more attractive something is, the more we have a reifying view of it. We think, whoa, that's great, the happiness is in the thing. The more aversion or hatred we have to an object, also the more the reifying view is. Like, if we just get rid of that, then I'll be free, I'll be happy. So the reifying view is what is underneath the power of social media. So what happens, how it's expressed with social media, is that if it appears, it must be true. So if it's on Facebook, it must be true. You know how many times Facebook has, you know, quoted the Buddha, and it's like clearly the Buddha didn't have something to say about sandwiches and lunch and whatever, you know, wellness and things, let alone what you hear about vaccinations on Facebook. But not just written, but if it appears, if there's someone saying it, it's so much more powerful if it's on a video than if it's just written. If someone's saying it, and if they look legit, if they're in a suit, they must be legit. if they're wearing a doctor's coat, like the plastic surgeons, you know, that have just got into trouble down in Victoria, they wear their plastic surgeon outfit with the head, their hair wrapped up in the little hanky that they have, and they look like a plastic surgeon, and then everyone thinks they're legit. And they're not even like qualified. So that's this thing. Why do we believe it? Because it appears to be like that. It appears true. And then what happens with social media? If it's not online, then it doesn't exist. So I think there's a saying like photos or it didn't happen. And thank goodness in my youth, it didn't happen because there ain't any photos. Whoa. So this one comes from that whole thing of seeing is believing. So if we see it, then we believe it wholeheartedly. And of course we know this is not true because there are magic shows where we see it and it's not true and we have that dissonance that happens and we pay money for a magic show because there's a certain thrill in that, in seeing it, believing it and knowing it's not true all at once. So there is a story I read in The New Yorker of a, I don't know if he was an extreme sports guy, you know, so anyway, he had his GoPro on his helmet, on his BMX bike or whatever it is, somewhere or other in South Africa, going through all this really rugged terrain and then filming it and everything. And one of the things that he wanted to do, no, it must have been somewhere in South America, was ride with the bison. And so you have these huge herds of bison and they're enormous beasts. So they've been tracking them through the bush and haven't been able to find any. Every day is the whole rigmarole of getting all the technology set up and everything. And then one day he thought, I'll just have a little quick ride and I'll go out. And he didn't have his camera on his helmet. So he's cycling along and he feels the ground begin to shudder like thunder. And then from behind him comes this herd of bison and they go by either side of him. He just keeps pedaling, right? And they go by either side and he's actually pedaling in the middle of this herd of hundreds and hundreds of beasts. Anyway, in this article that in The New Yorker, as he's describing, he's saying, and the only, here I am, you know, the thing that I've been living for, that I've been hoping for my whole life, and all he could think of was, I don't have my camera. And the entire moment was ruined. It was just like, no, instead of the great big yes, it was the great big no, I don't have my camera. And so it was incredibly traumatic. He got back to camp. He was crying, you know, just like the most awful thing. Where taking the film becomes more important than the experience. Anyway, it was such an extreme thing that he changed his whole life from that experience because he just thought, what have I come to with this that I can't even enjoy what's happening in the moment? So associated with that is our obsession with selfies. So why are we so obsessed with selfies is because we have this grasping at a self. So we go everywhere and we don't take the photos of everywhere, we take the photo of us everywhere. It's like this continuous need to reaffirm us, to reaffirm ourselves. So why do we have this continuous need? I mean, surely we could just take a photo of ourselves and there we are, done. Why do we need to do it all the time? So we need to do it because that self that we're grasping at doesn't actually exist. That ultimate true real me is not there. And so, of course, we need to continuously try and convince ourselves it is there all the time. And it doesn't work. It just wears off. It's just like if you feel really badly about yourself and people say, oh, no, you're fine, you don't believe it. You have to have them keep on saying it to you. So this the selfies phenomena goes right to the Buddha's teachings on no inherent self. There is no inherent self. So grasping it and trying to capture it and trying to present it and make it real and solid and as it is, not only does that self not exist in that way, but then selfies, of course, have gone off into a whole nother realm where you change everything about yourself. So when I went to Europe and I took some selfies of myself, I'm pretty hopeless at it, and I posted them, and my friends are saying, who I hadn't seen in years, oh, wow, you look so young. And it's like, it's not me, it's the phone. The phone, when someone took a photo of me from the front, I looked all old and bedraggled and, you know, and pimples and whatever. But when I took a selfie, it had this setting on it that I didn't know, that it just smooths your skin out. And no wrinkles, nothing. I'm like, oh, my God, like I really did look like 20 years ago. So I'm like, I can never go visit those friends now. Then in South Korea, they have a thing where when you put your resume in, you take your photograph of yourself and you alter your eyes so they become round, because you're more likely to get a job if you have rounder eyes. So they just alter their photos. There's this whole industry of whitening your skin and altering your eyes. So, you know, we have it with fashion shows. They stretch ladies' legs, you know, make their legs longer than their torsos and things, and then we see it. And now if we ever see a model that's the right size, they look stocky because we're so used to stretched women. So it's becoming quite unmoored from reality, isn't it? So the tyranny of the reifying view also extends out to become quite dangerous when it branches into fundamentalism, thinking my truth is right, is the only truth. The way I see it is the way it is, and that's it. Whereas we know there are many ways to look at a situation depending on who we are. There are so many facets of things. Or we go to the other extreme, nihilism. Nothing is true. Either one is an extreme, and it's out of kilter with reality. And when it's out of step with reality, that's when we end up harming others. So religious fundamentalists or political fundamentalists, in a way, are very sincere. Like, they really believe what they believe. But because it's out of step with reality, they end up harming others. They end up harming whole sections of society. With social media, of course, what happens is we get confirmation bias. We believe or notice only what we like, not what's true. And that's what the algorithms are set for, to show us more and more what we like, what we're attracted to. Not necessarily the truth. Not necessarily what's going to help us. And not only that, but the algorithms are set to enrage us. So this is the thing that Facebook at the moment is getting caught out on, that people will click on things when they're enraged more than even when they're attracted. So whatever it is, it's like we're all clickbait now. So that anything that you see that you go, what? Boom, we're involved immediately. So it doesn't actually matter what you put on there. So, you know, you can put Hillary Clinton was a pedophile in the basement of a pizza house or whatever, and that got on Facebook and hundreds and thousands of people believed it, to the extent that they went and bombed the pizza place. So why? Because you see it, it must be true. The reifying view drives that. And then our attraction to outrage because of our disturbing emotions, and we're hooked. Bam. So we can see how incredibly dangerous this can be within just an instant. So all of the stuff, all of the anti-vax stuff and everything like that, there's little factories in Eastern Europe, and what's the Belarus, I think, you know, various places like that, where they just post whatever crazy story, just make it up. They're probably going to make a movie about it one day. Then they see how many clicks that they get and they go, oh, that one works. What else can we say about it? It's just the whole thing's made up. And here we are on Facebook going, how can they do that? So not only that, but then we have this underlying kind of indifference. And so one of the books that I was reading was showing how indifference is actually an expression of, you know, we have those three poisons, attachment, hatred, and ignorance. So an expression of ignorance is when we're indifferent to others. They don't kind of matter. We don't have any direct relationship with them, so they don't matter, and they don't, if something terrible happens to them, it doesn't matter. So this happens a lot when I notice myself on the news. If it's news about Brisbane, I'm more interested because it's me and mine. If it's news about over there, it doesn't really matter so much. When we have indifference, then it means there's nothing holding us back from harming others. And when we have indifference online, it means that's why people just get all shouty and mean online. So it's not because they're actively mean people. It's just because the environment of being online, you don't have the person in front of you. And we have this underlying ignorance, this indifference to others or neglect of others. So it's the perfect setup that we just say stuff and it just comes flowing out and we don't even know what we're saying. And a lot of it's really harmful. So questions before we go on. Make sense? Heard most of it? Yet why it's so powerful is this reifying view, which is really what the Buddha's teachings liberate us from. If we didn't have the reifying view, none of this social media would have any hold of us at all. We'd just be like the young people are now with TV, like, you know, completely immune. So there's a couple of, here we go, case studies, alternate facts. I love that term. It's one of the most ultimate double speaks I've ever heard, and it's just brilliant, alternative facts. The refugee crisis, which has been going on for a very, very, very long time. And one of the things about it is how we describe it influences how we respond. So I was charting the way that the Australian media talk about refugees over the space of, you know, maybe 15 years or so. And it's gone from just actual refugees seeking refuge from disasters, you know, well, migrants back from the various wars. Then it became undocumented arrivals, which is fair enough, but there's no emotion there of seeking refuge, right? Then it became illegal arrivals, and then it became illegal aliens. So that's the wording just in the media and from the government. So what happens if you call someone a vulnerable human being seeking refuge, or you call them an illegal alien? Just by the words, it changes who they are to us. It's so powerful. So the Buddhist understanding of nothing exists inherently. What it exists is by imputation on a valid base, meaning by name, by a valid name. And if we change the name, we change everything. It's what leaders do when they, when one country invades another, they change the names of all the streets. Because it's a powerful thing to do. So the name shapes the reality. Then we have the lack of proximity. So if they're not in front of us, it doesn't matter. I remember Venerable Rabina telling this amazing story where she loves reading the news. She lives in America at the moment, and she was reading something terrible happened, and she thought in Tasmania. She's like, oh no, in Tasmania, that's like where this centre where I taught at. And then Then she went, oh, actually, it's Austria. She went, oh, Austria, oh, that's all right. And then caught herself like, oh, my gosh. And that's how we are, isn't it? And then we focus on the difference. So when we focus on the differences between us and others, the result is fear. When we focus on the similarities, fellow human being, the result is closeness. And we focus on difference when we don't understand people, we don't understand what's going on. It takes a lot of effort to see what we have in common. It's very easy to say where we're different, very easy to see. And then we have the cognitive fusion. Scary people, refugees, scary people, or people undergoing scary events. And on top of that, so for a while in the media, there was a lot of talk about the age of entitlement. And I found this really interesting because what the age of entitlement points to is how we conflate our good circumstances with ourselves. So then we think we're all fine and wonderful because of me. But actually, it's because I live in a safe environment, I'm educated, and I'm, you know, not going to be mugged when I go down the street and all of these things. Opportunities, education, and I think all of that is me. That's that grasping at a self again. And so then with that, taking all of that personally as if that's me, then anybody else that's in a lesser situation, then they matter less. So it's this terrible distortion. So then the other one, climate change. So a couple of years ago, some of the newspapers started saying climate crisis instead of climate change, which I think The Guardian started calling it climate crisis instead, closer to the truth. So we've got the time delay that's happening. And again, you know, the climate we're experiencing now is the climate of 30 years ago. It's what we did 30 years ago, we're experiencing now. So this is like, why does this happen? Because we don't understand karma. We don't have a grasp on karma. Karma, cause and effect over time. And there's a really big time lag. And when it's just a few years, it's easier to grasp. But when it's over 30 years, it's terrible. So what we're doing now is what the toddlers are going to be having the prime of their life in the future. They're not going to be very happy with us. So this time delay really catches us. We conflate weather with climate, of course. That's also a time delay with the immediate, you know, how can we have global warming when we're in the middle of a snowstorm? And again, our description shapes our reality. So it's a funny story, but it's a tragic story. Again, in the New Yorker, you know, in Florida, they have a lot of difficulties with climate change. You know, they have all the sewage coming up from the street every time there's a tidal surge and things like that. It's really quite disgusting. So what they did in Florida was actually ban any mention of climate change. Problem solved. So there's several governments that have done that. So if you can't name it, you can't fix it. You can't describe it. You can't fix it. So it's so powerful. Things are brought into existence by us naming them onto a valid base. That's called dependent arising. But that's how we work with our relative life, our relative truth. We have to be able to accurately name it. And if we can't accurately name it, we can't even deal with it. So just watching our speech, and so I became very aware of how my speech was influenced by this, by the media. And so I started thinking, well, you know, is it climate change? Is it global warming? Is it a crisis? What is it? Let's call it what it is. That's the way that we can actually start doing something about it. And also, it's on a large scale, so we feel powerless. But one person can have a huge effect. Just look at Greta Thunberg. What an amazing effect. What was it? School strike for Fridays, school strike for climate. Just one girl, one day a week, and look what happened. So we definitely can do something. We can do many, many small things. Okay. Questions, comments, anything else that springs to mind about how we describe it, makes it what it is? So boat people was with way back with the Kampucheans, the Cambodians, boat people, yeah, and the Vietnamese. Yes, but better than illegal aliens. Yeah, at least there's person in there, and the terrible, you know, coming in a boat is terrifying. Yes, it's there. Yes, so how it's shifted like that. And so in the Second World War, a lot of the Japanese prison camps, the prison guards were forced to call their prisoners logs, like logs of wood. So this prison guard was saying it was almost impossible to think of his prisoners as human beings when you have to call them logs, because you completely dehumanize them. And then whatever you do, it doesn't matter. There is the indifference there. The power of naming things, it's huge. Okay, so then let's have a look at some things that we can do. So the answer is quite surprising, because how do we keep ourselves nice on social media? What is it that actually restrains us from just letting rip? And it's because we have a conscience, we have a sense of what's right or what's wrong. And it's actually like a pain system. And surprisingly enough, out of the 11 positive mental factors, two of them, when we first hear them, we think they're bad things. So shame and embarrassment. Normally, if you hear about shame and embarrassment, you think, oh, they're awful. But actually, they're counted as positive mental factors. They're things that they're mental factors that benefit us. So this is, again, something, they might be a yucky feeling, but they're really crucial. They're really useful to us. So shame, which not being shamed, so not being humiliated or shamed, but a sense of shame, an inner sense of shame, to avoid negative actions due to having a personal conscience. So when we do something and then we have this sense of shame flow over us where we think, you know, that wasn't right, or that's not me, or that was an awful thing to do. So that's your own inner goodness and sense of fairness or whatever it is coming up. So when it happens, when you feel shame, it's a terrible feeling. But what if we never felt shame? What kind of person would we be? A psychopath, that's right. So shame is a lot to do with our personal conscience, and it has the function of restraining negative actions of body, speech, and mind. So it stops us acting badly, our conscience. Yeah, our moral compass, that's right, and we know when it's off kilter and we can justify it and whatever, but it doesn't sit right, does it? And so that feeling, that horrible feeling of it not sitting right, usually what happens is we try and get rid of that feeling instead of actually fix the situation. So that's this thing, again, cognitive fusion happens because it feels bad, we think it is bad, and then we just try and get rid of the feeling. And most people do that. So if you are filled with shame about something, often you can end up being an alcoholic, just drinking yourself to death because you're just trying to get rid of that feeling of shame. And it doesn't work, of course. We've got to go to the root of it. So often when we're trying to get rid of a feeling of shame, it's because we've been shamed or humiliated, and actually there was nothing to be ashamed about, but we haven't been able to embrace that either. Embarrassment, which is similar, avoids negative actions out of concern for what others might think. So this is where we don't want to disappoint our parents, Or, you know, when you see the docos of the kids going to jail and they're just like, oh, I'm so sorry. That's right, the one young, dumb and banged up abroad. Fantastic show. All these young kids from England go to Ibiza, sell drugs, get into trouble, get slammed into prison or whatever, and then they're like, oh, mom, I'm so sorry. That's their first thought. I just didn't want to hurt my mum. I didn't want to disappoint my parents. So embarrassment from what others might think of you can also hold you back from doing really, really stupid things. And I just think back at all those times where I got drunk and lost my sense of embarrassment. And, you know, there's a whole lot of things I regret. So those two things, they're the pain system of our conscience. They're there to indicate that there's something wrong. So they're both positive mental functions. They function to restrain negative actions of body, speech, and mind. And the cognitive fusion that happens is just because it feels bad doesn't mean it's bad for us. If we have a conscience, it means we can be true to our innate sense of fairness or right, what's right. And the reason I put these Buddha eyes up there is because both of these depend on being observed. Either we observe ourselves or others observe us. And this is a very powerful thing. So when we're observed, have I told you, was it this class about the putting the mannequins at the front door of the shops? So most of the shops in the shopping centre, when you go on clothes shops and things, you notice they have mannequins at the front of the store. And they have the mannequins there as you walk in at the front of the store so that you feel watched. Subliminally, so you feel watched. There are many other ways to get people into a store other than sticking a mannequin there. In fact, they could be really in the way. So the moment you go into a store and you feel watched, then it lessens shoplifting. That's the main reason for having those there. So the study that they did was about these eyes, about the watcher. And so they had the honor system box at work with the chocolates. You know, you put your $2 in, you get your chocolate. And so 1 week they had it just, you know, $2, there's the jar. And at the end of the week, there was a few chocolates left. There was a couple of dollars and there was a whole stack of IOUs. So there's, okay, so that's like the baseline, what happens. So then they put a nice smiling lady there saying, chocolates, $2, with a photograph on the top of the box. And pretty much all the chocolates had been paid for with $2. There's only a couple of IOUs. Okay, so how far can we take this? So then they just had a cartoon head. 1 week with a cartoon head, same result. Everyone paid their money. So then it's like, okay, how far does this go? So then they just had a set of eyes and not even a photograph of eyes, just cartoon eyes, just like a squid, like graffiti above the box of chocolates, and still people put their money in. So there's this evolutionary urge, you know, this biological thing that if we are watched, we're much more likely to be very, very good. So then, you know, you have the Buddha's eyes. So the Buddha's eyes, who's watching us? The Buddha. So in one way, it's like we want to be our very best. It's going to bring out the very best in us. And, of course, the Buddha's eyes are not judging us. The Buddha accepts us exactly as we are. So there's no being shamed or humiliation. We can be completely open. So there's a great stupa where these eyes come from, where the Buddha's eyes painted on each of the four directions, looking out to all of space. So it actually makes you feel protected rather than watched and, oh, I've got to be very good. But it also means that subliminally it's much easier to bring forth all of our good qualities. And so with social media, what we can do is, and it's really great that they're going to try and change the legislation now to be able to identify people. because that's the thing, that if you're anonymous, there is no watcher. So there's nothing holding you back. But the moment there is a witness there, the moment there's a possibility that your boss or your mum finds out what you said, immediately everybody's going to change what they say. It's really powerful stuff. Case study, Facebook. We've got our six factors. So we've got the first three. So the object, the related object is not just any old technology. It's not like passing notes in class. It's really complex technology. So it's much more powerful. Passing a note in class only gets to those few people. Doesn't get to the whole school. Doesn't get to your entire age group. Then we have, so the other thing about the complex technology. So at the moment, it's smartphones. But if you think back, say, in the French Revolution, the complex technology was the pamphleteers. So they had this technology that newly came out to be able to print pamphlets. So they printed all these little flyers and disseminated them everywhere. And that pretty much drove the French Revolution. Without it, it wouldn't have happened. So this massive revolution from a change in technology. So we're in exactly the same situation now, this massive change in our society from a change in technology. Then we've got the seed, the readiness for all of those things, the disturbing emotions, for low self-esteem, the universal need for acknowledgement, all of that stuff that's there, that's been there since we were cavemen and women. You know, human psychology has been the same. We have all of those, the seeds of the ignorance, the attachment, the hatred, all of those potentials. So that hasn't changed. And then we have the driver of it, inappropriate attention, which in this case is the reifying view. So the reifying view enslaves us to all the power of Facebook or anything that's online like that, so that we start thinking we are our profile. And if we think about it, so you look at other people's profiles and you think, oh, they're having a wonderful life. I wish my life was like that. So you believe their profile. They're thinking the same thing about you. And we're trying to post everything good about ourselves, our profile, as if that would make us better. We get addicted to living with an audience and with validation. And so that also gets turbocharged, doesn't it? So instead of just having this external need for validation, and relying on others all the time, which is that kind of sense of pride of always having to get our sense of worth reflected back on us. Instead of actually having a sense of worth within, it doesn't matter what people think. So social media has turbocharged that one, that you can get 999 likes and one thumbs down, and what are you going to remember? And what is it that's going to stick with you? So I threw myself off Facebook a few years ago now. I entered wholeheartedly into it. I spent hours on Facebook every day. I think it was leading up to the election. Can't remember if it was Tony Abbott getting in or Tony Abbott going out, or somewhere associated with there. Anyway, so I just read every single news report I could, and I post all the good ones that I could, and all the memes and the this and the that. And I'd spend hours every day trawling through all the news. And then I kind of started thinking, what's the ratio here, the amount of hours I spend online to the benefit that I get in my life? And now I think back, I did exactly the same in my 20s with reading the newspapers. I said, what's the thing with newspapers? So I started out and I went out and I bought The Age and The Australian and The Sun and The Courier Mail and all and the and the the Guardian, and I'd get them and I'd have them all, and every day I just read all the papers and I'd try and figure out what is it about the papers. So one of the things I figured out was the really important things are never on page one. They're always around about page 13 or 14 in a small paragraph with no picture. They're buried in the news. So I started tweaking on that one and learning how to read the papers. So that took me a good year. Then I stopped reading the papers. Oh, okay, got that now. So then same thing happened with Facebook. But Facebook is a lot harder to extricate ourselves from all that online addiction, the addictive behaviour, the bottomless bowl. But I was incredibly blessed to be freed from Facebook by Puntsog Rinpoche. So when Geshe Zopa came here with Puntsog Rinpoche, the young reincarnation, and he was maybe 12 years old and very self-contained. He gave a teaching here, age 12, to everybody. It was quite extraordinary. And I remember Venerable Rabina telling me about Puntsog Rinpoche and thinking, oh, what can I get him as a present? Oh, I'll get him an iPad or something. And so she asked him, I'll get you an iPad. And he said, oh, no, thank you. And she's like, what? And he's like, I don't want the distraction. So, yeah, wow. So I thought, okay. I was so amazed by that. And then when Puntsog Rinpoche and Geshe Zopa came here and they stayed here for 3 days. And just from being in his presence, on maybe the second day that he was here, I woke up and instead of reaching for my phone and Facebook, I woke up and I went, I'm free. It felt like I was freed of Facebook, and I've never had the compulsion to go back again. It was like this weight or these chains were lifted from me. So all of that FOMO, fear of missing out, that every you get tighter and tighter and tighter, it was just gone. So that's the blessings of the guru. It really is the most uncanny feeling. All right, so the social media, we've got all the things in here. We have our identity construct. Who we are is who we are on social media. We have no witness. We have a global reach instead of it just being really local. It's instantaneous instead of taking time, so we can't wind it back. And then it's driven by habit. So our society has changed and our brain has changed. It does actually rewire the brain for checking compulsions. Now, I had written down here, how many times do you think people check their phones each day? Do you know? Rough estimate? 200? Anyone else? More, less? 200 sounds about right. Oh, my God, you are so way off. It's about 2,700 times a day. That's just ordinary people. Not people who do social media, just ordinary people. That's an average. 2,700 times a day. On average, we spend about 3 to 5 hours a day on our phones, on our smart device. So that's really changed things, hasn't it? And we've got that the way that it's wired, so that you have to keep checking that there is no end to it. It's the bottomless bowl of the news feed. It just goes on and on and on. So we think, oh, that's just how it is. But actually, we've built it like that. So building our social media is an expression of all of our dysfunction as human beings in society, because there's other ways. There are apps actually out there that have algorithms that show you more beneficial things and that don't keep you tied to it, that actually you can set it up that all your emails arrive after 4 p.m. every day. So you have a space of free time. There's little mindfulness apps where the temple bells go off and then you set aside some space to remember to breathe and not look at your device. And there are good news. So now the news feeds have, you know, disaster, COVID, blah, 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 and good news. Everyone skips over that bit because it's boring. And my favourite app, which is called We Croak. Have you come across that? So it's this app that you get where you plug in your age, your gender, you know, whatever pre-existing health conditions you have, and it calculates when you're going to die and, you know, what statistically when you're going to die. And then you put it on your phone and it counts down. So you look at your phone, the whole time you're on your phone, it's going tick, tick, tick each second. Tick, 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 your death is getting closer. It's good, isn't it? It's a great one for stopping procrastination. So those factors there, all six of them together, they create a really powerful combination that makes it so difficult to extricate ourselves from. So I really like I like the media and I like TV and I like the news and all of those things, but great meditators, and like when Glenn Svensson was here, he just said social media is a disaster for meditation, for concentration, a complete disaster, because what it does, it's attention capture. So the whole time our senses and our attention are being drawn outwards over and over and over again, so our attention span gets much smaller, say, than if you're reading a book even, and there is no engagement in it. So we don't actually do anything with it. So there's a lot of combinations there. So what can we do? The genie is out of the bottle. We can't put it back in again. We can't make social media go away as much as we want. We have to work with it now. So one of the things, how do we inoculate ourselves from this need for social media, is instead of trying to have our sense of worth from how many likes we get or what our profile is like, to get our sense of worth by doing something worthwhile. It's such a radical thing to think of. Instead of just trying to feel worthwhile, what if we did something worthwhile? So it doesn't mean that we go out and cure the world of malaria or something. Doing something worthwhile could be as simple as setting an altruistic motivation every day and just not leaving the house till you've got that sorted. That's worthwhile. So we want to have a positive image, but really, why do we want a positive image? A positive image doesn't bring us any sense of happiness or contentment or respect. It's got to come from within us. There is a whole course that I lead called Everyday Dharma, and that's about even turning the boring things that we do each day into something worthwhile. So just making the bed or taking the rubbish out. With thought transformation, every time you take the rubbish out, you can think, I'm taking out the trash, the disturbing delusions, the disturbing emotions. I'm putting them in the bin. I'm putting the lid on anger and I'm putting the lid on hatred. So you get that as a thought transformation thing and it becomes a habit, and then that's what you habituate your mind with. So it doesn't, we don't even have to change much of the externals of our life to make it meaningful and make it worthwhile. It's our attitude that we bring to it. Educate. Educate and organize. Viva la revolution. So the Buddha said educate too. That's what we're doing, mind training, educating our mind. How come we're in the grip of this so much? So we can also harness social media for the social good, and that's what's happened with COVID, isn't it? We've organized, we've got online, Library Tumba Centre online. Thank you to COVID. We wouldn't be happening otherwise. And all the teachings from His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, from Geshe Zopa, from Lama Zopa Rinpoche, there's this amazing archive of teachings now that just would have been lost to the world because it just would have been in each center. Some centers videoed, some centers recorded, but that was about it, like a very, very small group. What else we can do is use all of our mindfulness training to pause. So Eddie's still on Facebook, and so he often says to me, oh, no, I really had to pause before I replied to that one. What the Buddha said about using our speech to ask three things: is it kind, is it useful, is it necessary? Oh, sorry, that's a typo. Is it kind, is it true, and is it necessary? So useful and necessary are the same. I have to fix that. Is it kind, is it true, and is it necessary? So I used to think, oh, just try and be truthful. But that's not enough, is it? Because people can say truth to us, like our enemy can yell at us a cold, hard truth. It doesn't land very well. So it's much better if the truth is said with kindness. It's much more skillful. It's got much, much better way of changing our mind. Kind, true, and necessary. Is it actually going to help the situation? So this is a very good little checklist. And I remember a class that Eddie led where he talked about this, and I think it was a weekend course. Then we had tea break. Then we went out and sat in there and no one said anything. It was very, very quiet. So it's a great way of, you know, we can engage, and it's actually much better to engage, but this will keep us nice. The other thing that I found quite interesting is to try and stay friends with people you disagree with, because that's what I started doing at first, was the opposite. Someone posted something and I disagreed with their political views or their this or their whatever, and like, oh, no friend of mine, unfriend them. And then after a while I started thinking, well, how are we going to change the world, folks, if we're not talking to each other? And how am I going to learn patience and tolerance? How am I actually going to try and put Buddhist philosophy into practice if I don't have a person right in front of me who I disagree with, that I actually get to try and remember they're a human being struggling, suffering just like me? But it's the last thing you want to do is actually keep them being friends. But maybe don't start with the really extreme ones, but keep a couple of ones that are a bit dodgy and just practice your skills with communicating, not just true, but really kindly or with a joke, just to open the communication channels. That kind of communication is what's going to change the world. Try and spend the day together device-free. Spend a day without a device. So some families do this. I think it's quite effective, putting all your phones in a bowl and putting the bowl in the other room. Very twitchy, that's right. So jury service, you put your phones away. How long for? Like, as long as you're in the jury room. So what, that's no more than a day? Or is it? It was a day, right? And yeah, right. So that's the habit. It gets hardwired in. You're checking. You're feeling like there's a gaping hole somewhere in your existence because you haven't checked your phone. Yeah. Phone separation anxiety. What else can we do? Try and have a meta-analysis, strong education. So all of those cyberbullying bullying workshops that schools are doing, that really educating ourselves, that we, the meta-analysis, what's happening online isn't what's happening with us inside. A couple of other ones, getting your emails at 4 p.m., setting those temple bells for a time limit browsing, so that you can set it that after you've been browsing for 20 minutes, it turns it off. And, you know, like with Zoom, If you've got a free account, you can only have a meeting for like 40 minutes. So everyone's been really happy about that because there's your perfect excuse. Got to go, like finished. No one wants to extend that out. But we can have that same thing too with a time limit for these addictive things. Then there was a couple of other things too. Instead of just reading the headlines, to actually read the whole article, because what we do is we read less and less and just keep scrolling through and none of it sticks. And I know I do this all the time. So I try and put some effort into actually reading the article and finding out, actually getting educated instead of just getting the hit of what the headline is. And the other part of that is to actually contribute back instead of just reading, to contribute to the feed. So instead of reading everybody else's, so there's another study of if you just go through everybody's posts without responding, you're much more likely at the end of, you know, an hour or two to feel really depressed about yourself and your life. But if you actually engage and start responding to others, and especially using kind, true, necessary, and building the relationship, then you actually end up feeling much better at the end of that. Then it actually becomes a social bonding thing. So it's all to do with, are we being passive about it, or are we actually engaging with other human beings just through this other media? And did I have? That's right, the question. Whatever we do, is it going to benefit others? We're doing it just for ourselves or for others as well? How is it going to benefit more than just me? So I thought I'd read this little something here from Yangtze Rinpoche, just about that, about the prevalence of depression in our culture and our society at the moment, and how social media really feeds into this. And especially with this one, the study is about if you just consume the feed or if you contribute to it. And so many people get really, really depressed on Facebook spending so long. So Yangtze Rinpoche says, many people in the Western world these days are afflicted with a mental sickness called depression. Depression happens when the mind is overcome by a very strong sense of craving for a certain object, for a certain person, for a certain experience. So, of course, when you're scrolling through pictures of this and that, that's what's happening, isn't it? This huge sense of craving. As this craving grows and its wishes are not actualized, aggression arises in the mind. The combination of these two emotions then gives rise to a sense of hopelessness. In some cases, the person may become suicidal, and in some cases, the person may become deeply depressed. The root of this mental state is the combination of extreme attachment and anger. When we are already caught up in these emotions, applying the ultimate antidote of wisdom that realizes selflessness is far beyond our ability. The best method to handle such an experience, therefore, is to prevent it before it occurs. And the most extraordinary, supreme way that we can choose to prevent it is to live in the joy of pure ethics. In fact, living in the joy of pure ethics is the best antidote for all of the gross delusions that arise in our minds. The mental sickness of depression can also arise from a deeply rooted sense of discontent, and combined with limitless desires and expectations for what life will bring us. Living in ethics can help us to liberate ourselves from unrealistic hopes and assumptions, and it can enable us to appreciate our lives without being trapped by desire. So this living in ethics, and it's not just ethics like being moral, but it's the joy of ethics, takes us right back to this top one of self-respect based on doing something worthwhile in the day. So even if we're not actually going out and saving the world, if we're living in ethics, so if what we do physically and how we speak with others are kind, you know, ethically sound, just that, then our existence is ethical. And that in itself lessens the craving, the discontent, the hatred, all of those things. Yet I don't think I've ever heard any Westerner say this is actually the way to lessen depression, to lessen the hold of social media, all of those things, to live in pure ethics. It's that comes back again to that core strength. So we can use all of the power of social media, that the power of the watcher, all of those to help us. We've got to set it off in that direction, the positive direction. Just a very quick one with this, when we're developing our care and compassion for others, there are a couple of ways how to keep our friendship with people that we disagree with. How to actually develop from empathy to develop compassion. So how do we get below that immediate disliking people or disagreeing with them? So normally our empathy is when we feel for people, it's quite emotive. If we see someone is upset, we kind of feel upset back. If we see someone's vulnerable, we kind of feel that. That's called affective empathy. If someone starts crying, we get a bit teary, all of that kind of thing. Affective empathy is also if someone's vomiting in front of you, you get a bit nauseous too. You know, so it's kind of that mirroring thing. Cognitive empathy, we have to think it through. That's when we try and put ourselves in someone else's shoes. So it takes some effort, and it's a logical reasoning kind of thing. So we need to have both, because if you went to the doctors and you're feeling quite ill, you got whatever, food poisoning, and you vomit all over the doctor's surgery, and then the doctor starts vomiting, it'd be no good, is it? You couldn't function as a doctor, right? So a doctor has to have really good cognitive empathy and not affective empathy at all when dealing with diseases. Parents too. Parents need to have cognitive empathy so that when their child is throwing a tantrum, they don't just mirror the tantrum back again and freak out, but understand what's going on and know how to respond. So to develop that, to use our empathy and develop into compassion, we use our existing good feelings of feeling for people. If we recognize their vulnerability, we recognize where they're fearful or scared. So my most challenging and difficult one is thinking like about right-wing extremists, you know, kind of the bogans. I've often been attacked by bogans when I was like a teenager, and you know, I've got a bad history of that. So then it's like, okay, it's very difficult to have affective empathy, to see below that fear. But I can develop cognitive empathy, which is all those disenfranchised people feel like, you know, their life now, they have no control and they're ripped off, and it comes from fear. So that I can understand. So then I've got the people that I feel for, that I can see they're vulnerable and I care about, and so all the nice mushy feelings. And then I've got the ones that I've worked it out, and you marry the two together. And that way you can actually include everybody. So you can have your compassion include everybody, not just the ones that you like or agree with. So this is the only way we're going to have a peaceful, harmonious world, because we can't make everybody agree with us. And they're too busy making us try and agree with them, and I'm not gonna. So what are we gonna do? So we get to it below these kind of like, dislike, and to develop compassion, which is a wish for them to be free of suffering, and it's an activity. It's not just a feeling. So it's not just an emotional thing. It's a lot more. And it has this sense of responsibility of doing something. So if we can develop this, of this compassion, this kind of intention to be able to help others, and it's based on something a lot deeper than just emotions, then when we go onto social media, naturally we're going to be able to be really beneficial. We're going to be able to create bridges, build bridges. So it's possible that social media could end up being like our boot camp. We do all of our study, we say our prayers, we set our motivation, we develop some compassion, we do a meditation on loving kindness and compassion, and then we go on Facebook and try it out. So if we do that, then we have the equanimity, the affection that we normally feel for others, we expand it to everybody because everybody has feelings. Instead of having the bland kind of meh feeling towards strangers because we don't know them, we raise the bar. We think if we did know them, we'd care about them. And the hard one, feeling concern for enemies. So that's being able to see below the scary face. So this is my go-to analogy, and it works every time because I'm pretty scared of guard dogs. And being a pedestrian, I've actually been down quite a few streets where there's been like stray dogs or loose dogs that have gotten out, and it's kind of scary. You're going into their territory. So, you know, you've got to keep yourself safe. But vicious dogs aren't evil, are they? Why do they end up vicious? They're trained that way. Yeah, that's right. And it's not pleasant training, is it? It's just, it's horrific. So then the result is that they're scary and they're dangerous. But if we have cognitive empathy for them, we can really care about it. We can actually try and rehabilitate them or save them, isn't it? We can definitely care without needing to give them a cuddle. And it would be foolhardy to try and give them a cuddle. And it'd probably be foolhardy to try and give a right-wing extremist a cuddle straight away too. But how do we turn our fear and our hatred around? So one way is to think, you know, instead of an angry person or a mean person, a fellow suffering human being who's lashed out. Using our words again. So hopefully with that, we can have a sense of equanimity, which is a level kind of feeling for others, but it's not level and bland. It's actually equal care. And His Holiness actually says it's like equal affection towards everybody. And His Holiness is so affectionate naturally, isn't he? He just has that warmth towards everyone, whether they're strangers or not. So equal care or equal concern, equal affection. Yes. Yeah, that's right. So just fighting them is just feeling the fight. It actually makes it, it validates all of that to them. And their guard is up and it's addictive and all the algorithms are built that way. But, yes, just a few words of compassion or actually seeing another human being there. Yeah, right. And so then he actually, yeah, so if we train our attitude, so that's our attitude, then if ever the circumstances come up, we'll naturally do it. We'll naturally show some kindness. We'll be ready for it. We won't be too shy or second guess ourselves or something like that, you know, which is often, you know, we just kind of put our head down and walk away, that kind of thing. So we do need to have some training in this to remind ourselves, and we're not going to get that training from social media. We have to train. We're going to get that training from Buddhism, from, you know, and all of the non-violent communication workshops. And yes, I think it's kind of like ex-right-wing military, you know, fundamentalist people that are the very best at the education, because they know exactly the workings of it. So if one person can change like that, so we've got to become more familiar with when we see that scary face, that we don't, so the reifying view goes bad from its own side. They can never change. But someone like that, who has actually changed, then has real understanding and compassion for all the other extremists. Yeah. So we may not be the ones that can change them, but we have to remember that they can change. Excellent. That's a great story. Yeah. I think there was a similar one too, again, a New Yorker magazine with some real fundamentalist Christians that were very anti-gay. And so one of the LGBT groups would just infiltrate their Facebook pages or whatever and just have friendly and very subtle conversations. So it's a real long game, and it's, and of course it's the oppressed, it's the vulnerable that have to put in the effort. And so over the space of quite a few years, this guy actually struck up a friendship with one of the ladies in the church, and started having really quite good conversations. And then that church came to town, and so they were going to meet. And so when they did meet, it was like the fundamentalist church, the LGBT rainbow flags demonstration, and the two of them met, and she kind of realized, oh my God, you're one of them. And he's like, hi, how are you going? But because all of this background was done, she was really happy to meet him. And again, then she completely started changing, thinking, wow, you know, you're nothing like what I thought, all of those things. And in the end, she started trying to change the church. So similar. It takes a lot of patience, a lot of understanding of human beings, human nature, and trying to remove that reifying view. So how something appears is not how it exists. Okay, so we've got a little bit of time to do a reflection. I wanted to just do this short reflection on the world of support, a different way to look at the world. All right. So let's settle our posture again. Just have your eyes just lightly open so some light still comes in. And, you know, it's been raining, the air is all cleared, and imagine that you're sitting on a hillside just after a summer rain shower and the air is clear. The sun has come out, and imagine that sitting next to you on either side are all the people that have really benefited you and supported you in your life. So the ones that without them you wouldn't have got this far, you wouldn't have survived. So, you know, your mother or father, very, very best friend. And feel how warmly you feel towards them, how naturally you want the very best for them, how you love being in their company, how good you feel with them. And feel that love that you feel for them as warmth and light at your heart. And feel that closeness and affection manifesting as golden light that flows from your heart to them. Feel that your affection and kindness radiates to them. And then sitting behind you on this lovely hillside on this beautiful day, all of your really good friends, your close relatives, everyone who's ever helped you, the really good teacher at school. Feel how they've got your back, how they've supported you in your life. Maybe a really good doctor, maybe an author of a book that changed your life. And feel the warmth and affection in your heart grow even stronger, and that warmth and light reach all of them. And as it does, they become happy and relaxed and free of any illness and free of all their problems. And then in front of you, a couple of people that you've had real difficulties with, and imagine that they're sitting calmly on the hillside too. Might be an unethical boss that you had to practice very skillful patience with. Maybe someone, a bully that you stood up to, or you protected someone from. Maybe someone from a relationship that you first got to practice forgiveness with. So all of these difficult people who've really challenged us, and feel that that warmth from your heart also flows to them. And when it reaches them, they transform and all of their negativities fall away from them like a crust. Their destructive behavior falls away and they become relaxed and friendly, completely freed of their inner torment. And then surrounding these groups of people are all the people throughout history that have indirectly contributed to our welfare. So all the inventors, all the people that spent countless hours inventing our watches, our computers, our phones, various software. If you wear glasses, all those people that even lost their lives through the study of optics. Everyone who's gone through experimental medical treatments so that we can have the most amazing medical treatments and medicines. All those women who fought for the suffragettes, who fought for women's rights, the unionists who fought for a fair wage and safe workplaces, all of these people we don't even know, and we're continuously benefiting from them. So looking around you on this hillside, these three types of people, the three types of relationships that we have, our friends who've kept our head above water, the enemies who have given us strength of character, and all of the strangers who we experience continuous kindness from. It's a whole world of support. So feel that warmth and loving kindness radiating from your heart, reaching all of them. As you breathe out, the warmth and affection in the form of golden light flows to all of these living beings. As you breathe in, the light and warmth of kindness flows back into you. As you breathe out, the warmth and kindness, the light reaches all these beings. And as you breathe in, great waves of kindness absorb into you and into your heart. So then we can bring this meditation to a close by dedicating that may we make just our very existence on this planet beneficial. Just by the act of breathing, may we develop our care and kindness just as the Buddha did. May we be able to have a great sense of equanimity and equal consideration for all living beings. And may we bring ourselves and them out of suffering and into happiness. You can gently bring your focus back to the room. So I hope you like the meditation. It's a really nice one to do to remind us, because there are those superficial distinctions, but we can really benefit from all of them. And it's a really nice way to train our mind in how to look at all the different types of people and have this equal benefit from them. And also it's going to be a great way to create a harmonious world and be able to do something about it.